Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the Church today. Luther's impact on education is the topic of today's show with your host, Pastor John Ehlers.
Hello and thanks for listening to Lutheran Radio UK. Today we're very excited to have with us Dr. Robert Rosine. Dr. Rosine is professor of historical theology at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, Missouri. But half the year, Dr. Rosine also works for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod World Missions Department as their coordinator for theological education in Europe and Asia, which means Dr. Rosine travels extensively throughout Europe and Asia, lecturing and teaching theology to folks in this part of the world. Currently, he is teaching historical theology and systematic theology at Westfield House, and we'd like to welcome Dr. Rosine to Lutheran Radio UK.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Now, Dr. Rosine, we want to talk today about Luther as educator, Luther as learner, his impact on education, especially as a university lecturer, and its relevance for Lutheranism today. Could you maybe give us a bit of background about Luther as an educator and his emphasis when it comes to learning?
Luther, of course, grew up in a late medieval context. The way he learned to learn originally was a late medieval way. It depended much on logic, Aristotle's logic, if A and if B, therefore C. It gave them, to put it very bluntly, the idea that if God is wise and makes no mistakes, if God gives us the law and says keep it, therefore we in some way, shape, or form should be able to keep it. We may need his grace to enable us, but our faith coupled with our efforts ought to get us there. And, of course, Luther always found that very unsatisfactory. For him, he always never found an answer to, where's my loving God? And it drove him to distraction. So he has a personal theological problem, and really it was the educational method, the approach that reinforced this. It was logical. What Luther came to see eventually was that it wasn't biblical. The way he came to this was really by using tools and techniques and texts, ideas that were coming from what could be called a kind of alternative educational movement. Renaissance humanism, the studia humanitatis, the study of mankind, what is man like, what makes man man. This had been cooking for about 150 years by the time Luther and the Reformation came along. From the middle of the 14th century, there were people who discovered classical education again. They saw a contrast between their medieval world and the classical world, and they liked the classical better. What did this mean? This meant things like classical Latin was better than medieval Latin. Then they said, well, there's also Greek. Many people wrote in Greek, and they learned the Greek language, turned to the Greek texts. They even went to study Hebrew. That was a little more difficult for them. There weren't the resources around, but they managed. So with a revival of languages meant a revival of texts. You have to read something to practice your language, which meant new ideas came up from classical antiquity. And the medieval world discovered that its approach to learning had been really kind of shrunk or kind of impoverished. In classical antiquity, they used to talk about three subjects to communicate, grammar, logic, and rhetoric, how a sentence is put together, then how I put sentences together to make sense, that's the logic, and rhetoric is then putting these in a kind of persuasive order to move somebody, to persuade somebody to think something, to agree to something. The communications or analytical skills then were turned on the subject matter in the world around them. And finally, they would study advanced subjects, law, medicine, theology. The problem was, in the 12th century, Aristotle was recovered. Aristotle had been known in part, but more of Aristotle's logical writings, Aristotle lived centuries before Christ, his logical writings were recovered. The church found these useful, a way to categorize, a way to organize. Aristotle gave them vocabulary to use. He gave them thought patterns which made sense of the world. Unfortunately, what sometimes happens is tools, like Aristotle's logic, wind up driving things, and the tool trumps the biblical text. They began to think, if God is wise and makes no mistakes, if God gives us the law, therefore, and then you can easily fill in the blank. Renaissance humanism said, not so fast. Logic has become too dominant. We have to look more broadly at the wider liberal arts and see that, if we can sort of make a play on the verse, a man does not live by logic alone, but by a variety of ways of looking at the world around us. Luther, somewhere along the line, bumped into Renaissance humanism. We don't really know where this began, but we know that, for example, by 1508, he and a couple of fellow Augustinian monks were teaching themselves Greek. And in 1509, when some new tools for learning Hebrew came out from a Hebraist named Johannes Reuchlin, Luther picked those up. So Luther and his fellow monks really kind of taught themselves. He learned languages and began to, and from the humanists, he also learned, secondly, not to first come with logic and impose it on a text, but rather to try and read a text for what it says, take it at face value. So he began to reread the New Testament. He reread Paul, and he discovered, for example, through the use of the humanist educational helps, that when Paul says we need righteousness to stand before God, this righteousness is not a quantity of good that we need to dump on God's desk and say, here it is, am I okay? But righteousness rather is a quality, a way we are, and that this comes only through Christ, his death, his atonement for us, with his resurrection is God's yes to that, and we can present this as our quality before God. When Paul says in Romans, when he gives a lot of law, this is not giving us more things we can accomplish. This is rather heaping up the law because we're so dense, we still think we can keep it. And so Paul says, okay, you think you can do that? How about this? How about this? Until finally we give up, despair of ourselves, and turn instead to Christ's righteousness. These kind of breakthroughs come not by using the old logic, but by using the new Renaissance humanism tools and their method of reading texts. So when Bernd Muller, this German professor, says no humanism, no Reformation, he's quite right. Luther, just to sort of close out this sort of longer segment here for you, Luther once wrote to one of his old university professors in the year 1518. The man's name was Trutfetter. He was a professor Luther had back at Erfurt. Trutfetter was one of the old-style medieval professors, but he was a little sympathetic to the new methods coming. Luther said to Trutfetter, I think that it is impossible to reform the church if we continue to use the canons and the decretals, that is to say, the rules and the regulations for the church. He says, until we give that up and install a new method, theology will not change and the church will not change. So Luther is well aware that how you approach things, how you do your exegesis, your interpretation of the text, matters greatly. Old method, old results. New method, new results, and from this comes the gospel.
Now you talk about the new methods that Luther was advocating. In the University of Wittenberg, I think I've heard you speak on this before, Luther did have a chance to bring a new curriculum in, or at least shape a curriculum. And you have said this is really the Renaissance humanism has helped lead to the discovery of the gospel again.
Yeah.
Can you explain maybe what Luther did at the University of Wittenberg to bring this about?
Sure. At the University of Wittenberg was one of the last of the kind of old-style medieval universities to be founded, but there was an important twist in its founding. Wittenberg copied the rules and the regulations, the kind of structure from other universities that were around. But in the charter for Wittenberg, when it was founded in 1502, there was an important line. Wittenberg was founded because Saxony previously had been divided into two territories. The universities that had been in Saxony all fell into one territory, and Luther's prince, Frederick the Wise, had no university. Frederick was a man much interested in culture, in trying to advance into his version of the modern world, and a university is necessary for that. So Frederick saw to the founding of the University of Wittenberg in 1502. In the charter for the founding of the university, you find all the typical stuff you would get in other schools. This is kind of their, you might look upon this as sort of their mission statement, although it's really an extended mission statement. It's what they intend to teach, how they intend to approach things. And in the very end, Frederick wraps up the charter by saying Wittenberg is now open for people for teaching of poesy and the arts. Poesy is poetry. It's part of the revival of the liberal arts in that day and age. In medieval universities, or in the cities of medieval universities, there were always what we call humanists hanging around. Now, humanism then is not like humanism now. This is not sort of modern secular humanism where man is the center of all things, where God no longer is part of the picture. Humanists there were all what we might call Christian humanists. They looked upon humanism as a way of finding out what was this creature that God had made. God made man in our image and likeness, it says. And what does that mean to fulfill this image? So they're on a kind of Christian track, even though they get a lot of inspiration out of classical antiquity and out of Christian antiquity as well. These humanists would hang around the universities, and they would very much like to be part of the curriculum. But the old medieval profs, the scholastics, they called them, the schoolmen, who were part of the method used, the logic, these people were not interested in opening the ranks. You could understand that. I mean, they have a monopoly on the approach to learning. Why should we step aside and make room for an alternative? So humanists could be around in university cities. They could offer their interests and their expertise on classical Latin, on Greek, on poetry, but they weren't part of the university proper. They weren't really sort of accepted for credit. They didn't really have a credit system like that, but people today would understand this. At universities, sometimes you wander around and you see all these posters stuck up about on the walls and on tied on defenses, new alternative lectures, new things people are doing. You'd get quite an education just by going to the extracurricular stuff. Humanists were extracurricular until 1502, and Frederick opened up Wittenberg and said, all right, we're going to have a kind of free-for-all here. The scholastics, you can come and teach, but the humanists will also have a place in the formal program of the university. And we'll see where the students go. We'll see who attracts and draws the crowds. And those are the people who are going to win out. Well, the scholastics struggled mightily, but the humanists were there as well. Luther came once in 1508, 1509 to lecture on a kind of a boilerplate entry-level text that the theology students all had to study. He had to follow the sort of accepted approach, the curriculum, or the syllabus, really, and the teaching method that was commonly used, the old medieval approach. He hated it. He found it deadly dull. He thought it really didn't advance anything in terms of theology, and he complained about the approach. He came back again in 1511, finished his doctoral degree, and then stayed on to teach. This was at Frederick's insistence. Luther was a monk. He didn't have money to pay his graduation fees, and so Frederick basically said, fine, I'll pay the fees out of one pocket into the other, and you stay as a prof until I don't want you anymore. And nobody ever told him to leave. So Luther's there. From 1513 on, Luther is doing lectures in the classroom on different books of the Bible. New profs are always scrambling for the first time when they do things because there's nothing to fall back on, no old ideas, no things you can use as a base to expand upon. I mean, you don't want to just haul out the old stuff and do it again, but at least you've got some experience and something to help shape the framework. Luther has nothing at the beginning. So he looks everywhere, and he looks to the comments that come from some of these Renaissance humanists on Psalms and then on New Testament epistles. He finds these helpful in uncovering the gospel as he reads the Bible, and he also finds peace. He finds out what righteousness means. And then he logically says, if I'm like this, my students must be like this. They're human beings also. They're plagued by their sin. And so he takes the new approach with him, he has to, into the classroom. Professors are obligated to do something new to advance learning, and so Luther does. He brings the new techniques in. He's got humanists around him in the academic community. He sees the old scholastics. And as profs would come and go, as teachers would change and move on to somewhere else, Luther got very involved in trying to shape the faculty and to shape the character of Wittenberg. He writes to the elector's advisors and says, for example, the fellow who taught a certain kind of logic, they had all sorts of logic. They had, you know, it was extremely detailed and well-defined. The fellow who's taught this kind of logic has left. Don't replace him. Find somebody who can teach on the New Testament texts, you know, preferably using the languages. So he's interested in agitating for turning Wittenberg into really a humanist university. Students vote with their feet, and they came to Wittenberg because they saw what was going on. Wittenberg took a big step forward in 1517, 1518. There was a visitation, a kind of an accreditation visit, you might say, of the university. There had been some complaints, not in the theology teaching, but elsewhere. People came from the electors, from Luther's prince's headquarters to examine and see what was going on. And Luther used the occasion to sort of bend their ear and make suggestions about what was needed. He does what every good school administrator does when the accreditors come. They come to look at your school, and things that you would like to get done, you sort of feed to them and say, wouldn't it be a good idea if, and they'll look at it, and they write it up and put it in their recommendations. Well, they went back, the visitors went back and said to the prince, you know, it would be really good if they had languages there as part of the formal curriculum. And so Wittenberg became the first university to have Latin, Greek, and Hebrew as part of the formal curriculum, the formal educational plan at the university. Philip Melanchthon came as the Greek professor. And of course, never stayed, and was played a prominent role in the Lutheran Reformation, in the Augsburg Confession and such. So Luther's very much involved behind the scenes because he finds the humanist insights useful. He agitates and gets more and more of this stuff into the university. That's what I mean when I say talk about Wittenberg being kind of a humanist center and Luther being a humanist backer. Even though I should add, you know, if people say, well, is Luther a humanist? That's a good question for debate. It all matters on how you define it. If you think that someone is interested in humanism in the new learning just for its own sake, then Luther doesn't qualify. You know, you find people who like Latin, or people today, for example, they'll like elegant French just for the sake of French. You know, but what do you do with it? Luther's very much interested in the practical value of these things. And so if you say you use humanism for humanism's sake, then Luther's not a humanist. But he certainly does use biblical humanism to help him understand the gospel.
You made a statement that really caught my attention. You said Luther discovered through the humanist forms the gospel. And he thought, logically, if this is my question, this is a question the students are going to have.
Mm-hmm.
So Luther didn't abandon logic and reason. So
no.
How did that fit into his understanding of learning then?
Right. Well, classical antiquity, as I said some time ago, classical antiquity understood the liberal arts really in two kind of groups. They had the trivium, try three subjects, three ways into learning, and then the quadrivium, four ways into study. The three ways, classically, were grammar, logic, and rhetoric. And then the four subjects were mathematics, another kind of logic, a way to analyze the world, geometry, that's understanding the world in spatial terms, astronomy, they said, which meant really all the natural sciences as they understood them in those days, and music, which was really the fine arts. That was the sort of subject matter. So you first did the trivium, how do you think, how do you learn, how do you analyze, and how do you communicate, and then they turned to the what. To the subject stuff that they would put under the trivium microscope, so to speak. in the trivium, you see, logic was the center of was the middle of the three subjects. It was the way of putting thoughts together reasonably, and it's a simple natural human thing. Yeah, Luther has no problem with logic as logic. Logic is a tool, but tools get out of hand, and it was the dominance of logic when it overrides everything else that really bothered Luther. But logic is around us. It's a perfectly natural thing to have. The question is, are you going to let logic be, allow logic to be the be-all and the end-all of everything you do? You know, in 1517, Luther wrote his 95 Theses against indulgences in October. The month before, he wrote 97 Theses, which we commonly call the disputation or the theses against scholastic theology. And in there, Luther lays clear his argument or his objection to logic and theology in this way. In the middle, theses 43 and 44 say something to the effect of, it is wrong to say that you become a theologian only if you use Aristotle. In other words, only if you think in terms of logic. The opposite, says Luther, is in fact true. It is only without Aristotle that you become a theologian. In other words, it's only when you stop letting Aristotle's logic dominate everything that you see the wider picture. For, he says Luther in thesis number 50, Aristotle's logic is to theology as darkness is to light. See? Tools can take over, and the logic of Aristotle had taken over everything. When that happens, then Luther objects to that. But Luther saw a perfectly good place for logic in terms of simple communication. He said Aristotle is very helpful in other subjects. It's just that you can't let Aristotle define how we're going to understand our relationship with God, because then you get into this if this, therefore. If God gives law, I must be able to keep the law, and therefore.
Yeah, and Luther seemed to really place reason at the submission of God's word.
Right. There is this famous quote where Luther talks about the great whore reason, Frau Holde, he calls her, you know, as if reason is simply bad. But you always have to ask about the context with Luther. And in that case, Luther's talking about reason getting out of hand. In 1536, he wrote a disputation concerning man, in which he starts off by acknowledging that Aristotle is very helpful in many ways in helping us understand what people are like. And then he goes on to say that reason is really multifaceted. There's a kind of natural reason which distinguishes us from, let's say from my cat or dog. You know, I guess I've just offended pet owners here. But the fact of the matter is they don't reason like human beings reason. Reason is something that makes people people. But then there is a kind of renegade use of reason where I wish to be in God's place. I mean, this is fundamentally the problem back in Genesis. Adam and Eve are not satisfied. They would rather step out of the creature role and be creator. It's a renegade reason that by which they rationalize the eating of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. There's also a regenerate use of reason, whereby reason serves as we look around and say, all right, I'm a redeemed creature, now what? What should my life be like? And teaching, especially teaching theology, talking about the gospel and what this means to people in their lives, is really appealing to regenerate reason. The Holy Spirit builds in us the mind of Christ, and helps us understand what God means. So Luther's not blanketly against reason by any means. It's really the misuse, of course. There's a great, if people want to pursue this a little more, Brian Gerrish, G-E-R-R-I-S-H. Brian Gerrish has a book called Grace and Reason. It's a very old book. You'd have to get it in reprint or used. Westfield House, I'm sure, has a copy. It talks about Luther's multifaceted approach to reason and lays it all out for people. It's really a good study.
So Luther uses his renewed in Christ reason to bring about some of these educational reforms. Now,
Right. That's right. Simple logic says if I find better answers, if I find something that is useful by using a certain tool, I'll use the tool.
And down through the ages of Lutheranism, it seems like we've continued that tradition because education has played a central role in churches around the world who are in the Lutheran denomination.
Right. Eric Buller's line, no humanism, no reformation, in a sense could be turned around as the decades move on to say, no reformation, no humanism. Now, that's a little bit of an extreme, because the Roman Catholic Church, with different presuppositions, also tried to use humanism to reinforce. The conclusion that you come to depends really on your method and your presuppositions. And if they're going to start with certain assumptions, you get a certain product at the end. So they tried to use humanism as well. The Lutherans certainly saw that what humanism had given them in understanding Paul, in understanding the vocabulary, the concepts, in putting together the theology. So they made sure that in the curricula of their schools, humanism played a major role. Not just universities, but even down into the preparatory schools, right down to the village schools below, there was a different way, even if you read catechism only in German, and that's all you ever studied, the outlook, the way you understood the language, what is being talked about in terms of law, is different. They see that the Ten Commandments, yes, they condemn us because of our sinfulness, but these were also given Israel in Exodus because they were already a redeemed people brought out of Egypt through the Red Sea. God is saying, all right, I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Here is now how you are. This is how my people look. See, and it doesn't then become a burden. It becomes simply a way in which to walk. And you study that, you think about that by using reason. So in the Lutheran schools, from the lowest level up through universities, they made sure that they had a heavy emphasis on language, on literature, and on the poetry, the affective side of human nature, on rhetoric, on how to speak to people and to lay out and persuade them of the truth. Not that you can sort of persuade anybody to be a Christian. The Holy Spirit finally does that. But you want to make the best presentation you can. Same thing with logic. Logic had its place, but we have to know when and where to use it. You can't, again, logically argue anyone into being a Christian. The Holy Spirit has called me by the gospel, Luther writes in the third article explanation. But you still at least can use it in right ways to understand the world around. Yeah, no reformation, no humanism. It became a part of the curriculum. And the Lutherans were never afraid then to go after kind of the latest and the best. It was popping up in terms of research now.
We're still fighting with that now, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Go on, expand.
Yeah, I was going to say, it doesn't mean that you're automatically obligated to take something just because it's new. But it does mean that you have at least the obligation to analyze it and to say, all right, in what way do I find this helpful, in what way not? And you've got to have a baseline, a touchstone for this. So we look at it and say, all right, does this further the understanding of law and gospel, or is this going to lead me off the track someplace else? See, the Lutherans moved forward. There is always a wonderful human tendency. I say wonderful with all sarcasm. A wonderful human tendency to want to kind of find something and then stick with it forever and ever and ever. To sort of build booths on the mountaintop. You know, Peter, James, and John went up, saw the transfiguration, and they said, it's good, Lord, to be here. Let's just stay. And they were given an education and told, no, you have other things to do. Christ has other things to do. We've got to move on to the plane and get on with it. Well, there's a human tendency to want to sort of build booths on the mountaintop. We create in our own minds these kind of golden age myths about times in history. And I mean that quite sincerely. I mean, the Reformation is a wonderful time, but the truth is, I'm not sure I'd want to live exactly then either, because there are plenty of problems and disadvantages. Each age has this. But sometimes you get people who say, oh, if we would just go back to the days of, and now you fill in the blank. See, just go back to the days of, the early church fathers. Well, look at the problems they had, and they didn't always get things right. Just back to the days of the Reformation. Well, look at the tumult they had. I mean, it even resulted sometimes in open warfare. Just back to the days of, and then fill in the blank, everything would be fine, but life is not like that. See, I mean, Luther understood that they were moving into a different era, and wise church leaders have always understood this. Even back, like in classical antiquity, near the end of the early church times, Gregory, when he was Bishop of Rome, seemed to understand that it was that while he was still interested in the Mediterranean, there was a new land opening up, new vistas to the north, France, German territories. This is now our new horizon. You know, you leave a ship from port, and you watch the buildings, the skyscrapers, the towers kind of get smaller and smaller as you move out to sea, and finally it slips over the horizon. Now you can stand there and say forever, oh, if only we had those times again. But the journey's moving on. You know, you've got to sort of turn around, what is it, keep calm and carry on? I think that's what the poster says you see around here from the war days, on the advertising and the coffee mugs and things. So keep your wits about you, get your mind in order, use the tools, and carry on. Move ahead. You know, God of the prophets, bless the prophet's son, says the hymns. And it goes on and says, each age its solemn task may claim but once. See, it's their time, their era. Use what's around, sort it out, make sense of it, and then meet the challenge. So Luther's 16th century was not the 13th, and it was not the 3rd. And the 20th and 21st century now, is not the 16th century. You know, you appreciate what they did, you learn from it, you glean from it, you take from it, and then you move on and move forward because you've got your own era.
Dr. Rosine, we'd like to thank you for being our guest on Lutheran Radio UK today. We very much appreciate your insight into Luther as educator and learner and how that can affect even our churches today as we seek to use our sanctified common sense and reason to use the tools that God has put at our disposal to bring the gospel of Jesus Christ to the world and to educate the next generation in law and gospel.
Thanks very much. I appreciate having been on the radio with you. I'm at Westfield House at the moment. I've been doing some teaching here. They're doing their best to sort of meet their task and claim the challenges there in front of them. And I'm sure the ELCEs as well. God's blessings to you all. The best.
Thank you for listening to The Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.